KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. Remote federal workers ordered back into the office are facing some rough conditions. Too few desks, bad Wi-Fi, not enough toilet paper. Does the administration have a plan? It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Today at the Supreme Court, can Congress cede its power to federal agencies? I'm Layla Faldin.
And I'm Michelle Martin. The justices will hear arguments about the FCC's ability to provide subsidized internet to remote and underserved areas. And an oral history of the music festival that came to define the 90s, Lollapalooza. It is Wednesday, March 26th. On this day in 1812, a political cartoon made fun of a voting district in Massachusetts that was shaped like a salamander, led by Governor Elbridge Gerry, eventually leading to the term gerrymandering. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The controversy has grown surrounding top Trump officials and their recent use of a commercial messaging app to discuss U.S. military strikes in Yemen. A journalist from The Atlantic was inadvertently put into this chat. The Atlantic has now released the unredacted text messages. These messages detail the exact times for the attacks, the type of warplanes used, even one of the targets. But top Trump intelligence officials testified at a Senate hearing yesterday none of that information was classified. Connecticut Democratic Congressman Jim Himes wants more action.
With a screw-up of this magnitude, there's only one response, which is, we are terribly sorry. We are standing down. We will do the investigations. We will get to the bottom of this. We will make sure it never happens again. And there will be accountability for the people who were involved. You know what we didn't hear yesterday? A single one of those assertions.
Meanwhile, White House spokeswoman Caroline Levin has released a statement. She claims the entire Atlantic story is a hoax. The U.S. military attacks did occur. In Gaza, Palestinians staged a rare protest against Hamas, the militant group that rules the territory. Israel resumed fighting last week to pressure Hamas to release remaining hostages. NPR's Daniel Estrin reports.
Videos posted on social media show crowds chanting, out, 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 Hamas go out. Protesters called for media coverage, chanting, where is the media? Eyewitnesses say thousands took part in the demonstration in Beit Lahia in northern Gaza, which began as an anti-war protest. One protester who requested we only use his first name, Ibrahim, to speak freely against Hamas, told NPR, Hamas is not taking us into account. It has 2 million people in Gaza who need to live. He called on Hamas to release the Israeli hostages and leave Gaza. Over the years, Hamas has cracked down on dissent, but open criticism has grown during the war. Hamas did not break up the protest. It issued no comment. Daniel Estrin, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
Stocks open mixed this morning as discount retailer Dollar Tree unloads its Family Dollar business. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose about 170 points in early trading.
Dollar Tree paid more than $8 billion to acquire the Family Dollar chain back in 2015, but the discount retailer has struggled to make the blended family work. So now Dollar Tree is selling off Family Dollar to a pair of private equity funds for about $7 billion less than it paid a decade ago. New orders for long-lasting manufactured goods rose last month, led by a jump in motor vehicle orders, but a key measure of business investment was down. Businesses may be reluctant to invest right now, given the uncertain economic outlook. People are still spending money on pets, though. Online pet store Chewy delivered better-than-expected sales for the most recent quarter and a tail-wagging forecast for the rest of the year. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow is now up 160 points. This is NPR. It was a year ago today, a cargo ship collided with the Francis Scott Key Bridge just outside Baltimore. Parts of the enormous bridge collapsed, killing 6 construction workers. The port of Baltimore was closed for months because debris choked the river. People around the world are switching religions. NPR's Jason DeRose reports on a new study from Pew Research that finds large portions of adults no longer practice the faith in which they were raised.
Religious switching is especially common in East Asia, Europe, and the Americas. In South Korea, Pew found that 50% of respondents had changed religions. In Spain, 40% said they'd left their childhood faith. In the U.S., 28% switched, and in Colombia, 25%. Christianity and Buddhism have experienced the largest losses. The biggest gains were among those who have no religious affiliation, atheists, agnostics, and those who describe themselves as nothing in particular. Pew found very small percentages of people either left or joined Islam. The retention rates for Hinduism and Judaism are also high. For the study, Pew surveyed nearly 80,000 people in 36 countries. Jason DeRose, NPR News.
Lawmakers in Florida are advancing a bill that would relax laws on child labor. The proposed change would let children as young as 14 years old work overnight and on school days. The legislation must be reviewed by two other Florida state Senate committees. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis says a younger workforce could help be the solution to replace labor by migrants who are in the United States illegally. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Lilly Endowment, a private foundation supporting NPR's coverage of religion and spirituality, and Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Fadel. Sensitive text messages between top U.S. officials about a planned attack on Yemen are now public. This morning, The Atlantic magazine published those messages, which officials had inadvertently sent to the magazine's editor, Jeffrey Goldberg, in a group chat on the app Signal. The magazine says it chose to publish the messages after Trump administration officials asserted Goldberg had lied about the contents of the chat. Members of Congress are expected to question defense and intelligence officials today about their use of Signal to discuss war plans. So how secure is the app? Matt Blaze is a cybersecurity expert and a professor at Georgetown University Law Center, and he joins me now to help answer that question. But before we dive in here, we just want to note that NPR CEO Catherine Marr chairs the board of the nonprofit Signal Foundation. Good morning, Matt.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So with this group chat fiasco playing out here in Washington, I have to ask if this messaging app Signal is as secure as the secured communications the U.S. government uses to protect sensitive and classified information.
Right. And the answer is yes and no. Mm-hmm. Signal is a general purpose text and voice communication app that uses a technique called end-to-end encryption to protect calls and texts from interception by a third party. And this includes everything from your internet service provider, government eavesdroppers, foreign or domestic, and even the Signal organization itself. And this is a much more comprehensive form of protection than you usually get on a regular smartphone. So in that sense, it's comparable to the level of protection you get against eavesdropping that the official government systems use. Mm-hmm. But there are a number of important differences. When you start using Signal for a purpose it's not intended for, which is, you know, classified discussions.
And what are those differences?
Well, the encryption is very similar, but apps like Signal are designed to facilitate communication with basically anyone on the internet who has the app, even if they're from different organizations, even if you've never met before. And essentially any two people who have the Signal app can use it to exchange messages or call each other. The systems for protecting classified communications, on the other hand, actually try to do the opposite. They have special features to restrict communications to ensure that it only goes to places that are authorized to get it. So in the, you know, government systems for doing classified communications, it would be pretty much impossible to accidentally add a reporter to a war planning chat group.
I mean, I guess it's really easy to eavesdrop if you're invited in, but it is also supposed to be vulnerable at times to phishing attacks. I mean, the Pentagon warned about not using it.
So, and the Pentagon, again, warned for good reasons, because it's just not designed for the kinds of requirements that classified information protection has, like knowing exactly who you're communicating with, what clearance level do they have, are they really in the organization you think they're in.
Now, Signal can also, you can set timing to disappear messages. I mean, how does that work with laws around official record keeping when it comes to government communication?
Yeah, that's another reason that Signal isn't appropriate for high-level government communications. It's not designed to comply with or even make possible rigorous record-keeping requirements.
Matt Blaze is a professor of computer science and law at Georgetown University Law Center. Thank you for talking with me.
Thanks for having me.
At the Supreme Court today is another challenge to the way federal agencies operate. The issue basically boils down to this. Did Congress overstep when it tasked the Federal Communications Commission with getting accessible and subsidized internet to remote and underserved areas? NPR Legal Affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg reports.
At the center of the case is Article 1, Section 1 of the Constitution, which has just 25 words. Quote, "All legislative powers herein granted shall be vested in a Congress of the United States, which shall consist of a Senate and House of Representatives." It's called the Vesting Clause because it vests the country's lawmaking power in Congress. But it says nothing either way about when or if Congress can delegate its powers. Some conservatives have long argued that Congress may not delegate its power at all. Others say it's a question of degree. But in any event, today's case involving the FCC could make it much more difficult for Congress to establish programs and authorize agencies to carry out congressional objectives. More than 90 years ago, Congress created the FCC to ensure the availability of affordable and reliable communication services throughout the United States. Initially, the agency established a system of implicit subsidies by requiring telephone companies to charge below-cost rates in rural areas where it was harder and more expensive to build phone networks, while in cities where it was easier to build those networks, the agency allowed the phone companies to charge more. In other words, in order to create universal service available to all, city dwellers were subsidizing rural areas. By 1996, though, the world of telecommunications was bursting with innovations from the internet to broadband, and Congress overhauled the act, among other things, replacing the old system of implicit subsidies with explicit subsidies. Under the 1996 law, the FCC is charged with figuring out how much each telecommunications company must pay into the Universal Service Fund, and for all practical purposes, the charges are passed on to customers on their telephone or internet bills. The question before the Supreme Court is whether that system is an unconstitutional delegation of congressional power. Challenging the law is Consumers Research, an anti-regulatory conservative group that targets what it considers woke policies. It contends that the way the Universal Service Fund works amounts to a tax and that only Congress can enact taxes. So the system is unconstitutional. Representing the group in the Supreme Court is lawyer Trent McCotter.
The power here is the power to tax, which is a power that's very strictly legislative.
He contends that not only has Congress unconstitutionally given away its power over taxation, it's done so twice over because the FCC created a nonprofit private contractor to figure out how much each telecommunications company must pay into the Universal Service Fund. The agency counters that the Universal Service Fund fees are not a tax, and that whatever one chooses to call them, they were authorized by Congress in order to ensure coverage for rural areas. Indeed, providing universal service is the core mission of the FCC, says Republican Richard Wiley, who served as chairman of the agency during the Nixon administration.
Somebody's got to run the program. Congress can't run the program after they set it up.
That's what the FCC was established to do, he says, adding that Congress authorized the nonprofit that manages the fund payment system to be supervised by the commission.
This is really getting into the nitty-gritty of whether a E-rate company has submitted the proper charges for their services, whether people have applied these particular programs properly.
This is not a rubber stamp system, he says, noting that during his tenure and since then, the commission has overruled the findings of the nonprofit manager from time to time. Two federal appeals courts have sided with the FCC in this case, and one, the conservative Fifth Circuit, has ruled the other way, invalidating the FCC's Universal Service Fund as an unconstitutional delegation of congressional power. Now the Supreme Court, with a 6-3 conservative majority, will have the final say on whether to revive the long-dormant so-called non-delegation doctrine. If it strikes down the FCC program, the implications across the regulatory spectrum could be profound. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
So college basketball fans, you already know March Madness is well underway, but do you know about March Napness?
That's right. Napness is where bears are unknowingly, because they're asleep, entered into a hibernation competition.
March Napness is a bracket-style tournament, which we do every year. The bear that remains sleeping the longest is crowned king or queen for that year.
Clara LaFrance is with the International Animal Welfare Organization, Four Paws.
As long as we've been doing this competition, it is a nail-biter. I mean, they will have you on the edge of your seat. It's really anybody's guess.
Four Paws houses more than 135 rescued brown bears in sanctuaries around the world, mainly in Europe.
These are European brown bears, and most of them are rescued from inappropriate or inadequate keeping conditions. So these bears are bears that cannot be returned to the wild.
LaFrance says their bears typically start hibernating in October or November, and they can sleep well into April. Out of the 23 bears competing this year, about a dozen are awake now.
They're on their own time. They wake up when they want.
They need to be awake for 5 consecutive days before they are disqualified.
When animals, especially bears, hibernate, they can actually wake up from time to time. You know, it's not like this comatose. They can wake up. They can get out of their den. They can walk around, maybe have a snack, and then go back to sleep.
And individual bears don't wake up at the same time every year.
We have this bear, Tyson. He was one of last year's finalists in March Napness. And in a shocking turn of events, he woke up in the earliest phases of the competition. And he's just snacking on apples and totally living his best life.
LaFrance says no one has ever predicted the outcome with a perfect bracket. Some swag is waiting as a prize if there's a first timer this year. But she says the real winners are the bears.
They could really help bring back the movement that sleep is self-care. And there's no harm in taking a little nap when you need it.
Well, we know that. Layla, between us, who do you think would win?
I mean, when you said March Napness, I was like, this is a competition I can get behind. this is my area.
Right, this is your superpower.
This is my superpower. Naps are delicious.
This is NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, in a new book, Amanda Knox shares the difficulties she faced after being convicted and later acquitted of killing her roommate during a study abroad program in Italy. She'll talk about her journey to reclaim her identity from the notorious tabloid stories that defined her for years. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Sony Pictures Classics, presenting The Penguin Lessons, a new comedy starring Steve Coogan as a teacher whose life is upended after he rescues a penguin from an oil-slicked beach. Starts Friday in theaters. From BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 30,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public. From Easy Cater, committed to helping organizations order and manage food for all their business needs, with online ordering from restaurants nationwide, employee meal programs, and tools to control food expenses at easycater.com. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm A. Martinez. In the early 1990s, American rock music was just beginning to emerge from the hair metal era. And one of the most influential bands to lead the transition was Jane's Addiction. Just as Jane's Addiction was starting to gain traction, though, the constantly feuding band announced their final tour in 1991. Frontman Perry Farrell invited some of his favorite bands to hit the road with them, and he called the traveling music show Lollapalooza, and it was chaos right from the start.
They come out on stage the first night, and the two principal members, Perry Farrell and Dave Navarro, start brawling on stage.
That's Richard Beanstock. He's one of the editors of a new oral history of Lollapalooza. Tom Bojour is the co-editor. He added that the band Nine Inch Nails also had a rough first show.
The entire Nine Inch Nails musical system is plugged into this one electrical drop box, and it just shorts out. And Trent Reznor freaks out, smashes his equipment. Everybody else smashes their equipment.
Instead of folding on day one, Lollapalooza went on to define what rock would become in the 1990s. Richard Beanstock and Tom Bojour interviewed hundreds of people responsible for making that traveling circus possible, including its founder, Perry Farrell.
His vision was really to represent a diverse set of bands, which he did. He had Ice-T, Susie and the Banshees, but also a diverse set of ideas. So that's why he developed the idea of having all of these booths and tents around where he would hopefully, as he said, have the NRA next to Greenpeace and really showcase opposing ideas. You know, that he was really idealistic and maybe unrealistic, but that was his brief. He really wanted to make something where different ideas came into contact with each other.
It was exciting, chaotic, a lot of fights, a lot of drugs. What's your favorite story that you heard from the people you interviewed?
There is like a lot of very, very weird stuff. I think the strangest thing that happened was in 1994 when the band L7, who were an all-female punk rock band, teamed up with Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds. And they were so bored that they decided to create paper mache cars and wigs and reenacted the Kennedy assassination on stage, and not only on stage, but in Dallas. And it went over very badly. That really sort of shows off the kind of bad judgment and cabin fever that can occur when you spend 8 weeks on a bus.
Richard, you were there, right? You were there for the first 3 years. So, I mean, it lasted for actually maybe longer than anyone would have thought, considering how it started. How did Lollapalooza eventually find its footing?
I think that even with all the technical type difficulties that we're talking about on the first night, Perry had a great vision. Some of the other organizers, like, these were people that were pros and were pretty keyed into the scene. Some of it is also just being right place, right time. Lollapalooza 1991 happens less than a month after it finishes. Nirvana's Nevermind comes out. So by the summer of 1992, alternative music is fully mainstream, and Lollapalooza is fully in the center of that.
And Richard, one of the unique things, though, about Lollapalooza is that it really tried to cross boundaries and mix genres. Ice-T on the first tour, along with his heavy metal band Body Count, then Ice Cube, Coolio, Snoop, they all played Lollapalooza. What was the idea behind bringing all of these genres together in one place?
It really was a unique thing at the time, and now it's something that we just kind of take for granted. I mean, if you look at any of these festivals, Coachella, Bonnaroo, it's hip-hop and pop and rock and all these things right next to each other. But that was not happening in 1991. And again, that was one of the main conceits of Lollapalooza, that you could do something like this. So the fact that they were doing it, like, should not be underestimated. It really was a unique thing at the time.
Yeah, and the thing is, too, like with Perry Farrell, as much as he was the genius and inspiration behind Lollapalooza, if he had gotten his way on certain decisions when it comes to lineup, there might not have been Pearl Jam at Lollapalooza in 1992. There might not have been Green Day at Lollapalooza. I mean, how many creative clashes were there when it came to figuring out who exactly would be at Lollapalooza, Tom?
I think that there was a lot of behind-the-scenes friction, and the founders say to us, you know, we were music snobs. So they really did not book a lot of the sort of more popular alternative rock bands of the era. So there was a constant push and pull between what was cool, what was commercial enough. And of course, this sort of ends up with the festival booking Metallica as a headliner in 1996, which is pretty much considered the moment when Lollapalooza jumps the shark. Perry Farrell is so incensed by Metallica being made the headliner that he actually steps down from the festival altogether. And while it does draw more people, it really doesn't do that well because of the increased cost, and it never really recovers the gleam of being this alternative bastion and sort of North Star.
Richard, considering that you were there as a teenager watching the first few shows, is this book a bit of a love letter to Lollapalooza as opposed to the uncensored story of Lollapalooza?
I think in some ways it probably is. I think even if you love something, if you just show that side of it, then you're not really showing much anyway. So within all of the gritty details, I think that the real personality of it comes out, and hopefully that's what we captured.
It's also a little bit wistful because, according to all of the people involved with the festival, given the economics of touring now, a festival like this that would tour around the country with this many artists of that stature is actually impossible to do. So it's really an artifact of a bygone time. It's not going to happen again. So it's a celebration of something that can't be reproduced.
Richard Beanstock and Tom Bozier co-wrote Lollapalooza, the uncensored story of alternative rock's wildest festival. Richard, Tom, thanks for taking us back.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much for having us.
Lollapalooza does still exist, but now it's just a four-day affair in Chicago's Grant Park with a few international spin-offs. This is NPR News.
So-called marginal wells make up more than three-quarters of the oil wells in the U.S., but account for just a fraction of oil production. But don't let the name fool you.
Marginal wells are not a marginal issue. There's 800,000 of them. Most wells are marginal wells.
I'm Elsa Chang. What makes marginal wells a big deal to oil producers and environmentalists? On All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. The Atlantic has published additional text messages sent by high-level members of the Trump administration in a Signal messaging app that inadvertently included the magazine's editor-in-chief, Jeffrey Goldberg. The group chat of March 15th detailed plans for U.S. airstrikes targeting Houthi rebels in Yemen. Goldberg spoke about it this morning to MSNBC.
we decided that we should put the text out so people can see whether or not this is, from a plain understanding of what secrecy is, whether this material was appropriate to put on a commercial messaging app.
The messages included a text from Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth referencing specific times for airstrikes targeting the Iranian-backed rebels. The White House has said the group chat included no classified information. Last night on Fox, the president's national security adviser, Mike Waltz, told show host Laura Ingraham he takes full responsibility for the incident, acknowledging he built the group. The National Security Council is investigating. The CEO of NPR, Catherine Marr, chairs the board of the Signal Foundation, a nonprofit that supports the messaging app. A top Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee tells NPR the war plans discussed on the app should have been classified at the highest levels. This is NPR News. In a 7-2 vote, the U.S. Supreme Court is upholding a Biden administration regulation on firearms. It involves so-called ghost guns. It requires them to have serial numbers, and buyers must undergo background checks and age verification to buy kits to build the weapons. That rule was finalized in 2022. Gun rights groups had argued the federal government was overstepping its authority. The Senate has confirmed a Stanford University researcher as the next director of the National Institutes of Health. Here's NPR's Rob Stein.
Dr. Jay Bhattacharya, a Stanford health economist, was easily confirmed by the Senate. Bhattacharya takes over the NIH at a time when the world's biggest public funder of biomedical research is in turmoil. The NIH has lost hundreds of employees so far in the Trump administration's efforts to shrink the federal workforce, terminated hundreds of grants to medical researchers across the country to comply with executive orders, and could be facing a major restructuring as the administration refocuses the nation's federal health agencies. Rob Stein, NPR News.
The Commerce Department says orders for durable goods in the U.S. rose last month, led by stronger demand for vehicles. Stocks are mostly lower on Wall Street. However, the Dow is up 158 points. I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Fisher Investments. Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Moderna, committed to protecting people from COVID-19, the CDC recommends getting a second dose of this season's COVID-19 vaccine for those 65 and older. Doctors can advise about getting a second dose. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Michelle Martin. The Trump administration is in damage control mode after the revelation this week that top national security officials shared secret war plans in a group chat that included a journalist. President Trump was asked about it yesterday and said no classified information was shared. The journalist in the chat, The Atlantic's editor, Jeffrey Goldberg, decided to share the full thread this morning so people could reach their own conclusions. NPR Justice correspondent Ryan Lucas is covering this, and he's with us now with more. Good morning, Ryan.
Good morning.
So The Atlantic just published the full text chain this morning. What was the thinking about this? Why now?
All right. Remember, the chain was about a U.S. military strike against the Houthis in Yemen. And so initially, The Atlantic did not publish the full chain of text because of how sensitive the information was. The magazine says it generally doesn't publish information about military operations that could put American forces at risk. But the Trump administration has tried to downplay the gravity of all of this. The White House has said that no classified information was in the chat. The Director of National Intelligence and the CIA director yesterday both told Congress the same thing. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth has said nobody was texting about war plans. And then on top of all of that, administration officials have attacked the credibility of The Atlantic and Goldberg. And so this morning, the magazine published the group chat in full so the public could decide for itself.
So what does it show?
Well, it shows that on March 15th, the day of the U.S. strikes in Yemen, that Defense Secretary Hegseth provided details about the timing and aircraft to be used in these strikes. The material posted by The Atlantic shows that Hegseth texted the group that the airstrikes were confirmed to go forward. He followed that up with details, as I said, on the timing and the aircraft. He texted that the first F-18 fighter jets would take off at 12:15. A second wave would launch at 2:10 p.m. He didn't give the specific targets there. But I think it's important to note here, as The Atlantic does, that this was all before the planes took off. So if that information had fallen into the hands of an American adversary, the Houthis, in this instance, could have repositioned their defenses with potentially deadly consequences for American service members. One other thing here caught my eye, and that's that National Security Advisor Mike Waltz followed up what Hegseth had texted with what appears to be real-time intelligence assessment of the damage caused by the U.S. strikes. He said a building had collapsed and that they had multiple positive IDs on folks who had been killed.
So the White House has been trying to play this down using words like glitch and so forth, calling it a glitch and, you know, things like that. And as you mentioned, officials have also been trashing Jeffrey Goldberg. But now that this whole thread has been published, have they changed their tune at all?
Not at all. Not at all. They've doubled down, in fact. White House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt called this a hoax today on social media. Mike Waltz, the National Security Advisor, he posted on social media as well that there were no locations in the chat, no sources and methods. He says no war plans. The bottom line here, he says, is, quote, President Trump is protecting America and our interests. Although as I said earlier, the chat did include the timing and weapons and attack sequencing. However you want to characterize this, former intelligence officials say this is not the sort of information that should be shared on a commercial messaging app. There are secure government networks for this.
So where might this go next?
Well, the CIA director and the director of national intelligence were grilled by senators about this yesterday. Those two officials are back on Capitol Hill today testifying before House lawmakers. They will certainly face questions about it. We have new information now with this group chat, so we'll see what how they respond to these new revelations. The top Democrat in the House and the Senate yesterday called for an investigation into this group chat snafu. Democrats, of course, don't have a lot of power. They're in the minority. Republicans control both houses of Congress. Some Republican senators have expressed concern about this. That includes the Senate Majority Leader John Thune, who said yesterday that lawmakers need to figure out what happened here. We'll see how the publication of the full chat affects their appetite to really dig in on this matter.
That is NPR's Ryan Lucas. Ryan, thank you.
Thank you.
And I do want to mention that Catherine Mara, who is the CEO of NPR, chairs the board of the nonprofit Signal Foundation. Earlier this month, a Department of Agriculture employee who works remotely was told they'd soon have to start reporting to an office. The employee was given a list of possible locations, including one described as a storage unit. NPR's Shannon Bond spoke to that worker and other federal employees who have been ordered back to the office and who say they are dealing with challenging conditions. And she's with us now. Good morning, Shannon.
Good morning, Michelle.
So, Shannon, a storage unit? What's going on there?
Yeah, this USDA worker was pretty confused by this, so they actually drove to the address on this list. Sure enough, it was a storage facility. And when the worker asked the owner of the facility why it might be showing up on a list of federal office spaces, they said the owner laughed and said, yes, you know, the federal government does rent a unit here. It's used to store a boat. Now, to be clear, this employee doesn't expect to actually be working out of this storage unit. Like other federal employees I spoke with, they didn't want us to use their name because they fear retaliation from the Trump administration for speaking out. I reached out to the USDA. They told me they are identifying issues and addressing them quickly. But Michelle, this is just one example of the kind of confusion, even absurdity, some federal workers are encountering around this order back into offices.
What are some of the other stories that you've heard?
Yeah, my colleague Jenna McLaughlin and I talked to employees at a dozen agencies who are being ordered back into the office to comply with President Trump's executive order terminating all remote work. And what they told us is in many cases, these offices just are not equipped for an influx of people. So they're running out of toilet paper and soap in the bathrooms. There aren't enough desks or computer monitors. Internet connections and Wi-Fi service can be slow or unavailable. You know, I even spoke to people at the FDA who went back to the main office in Maryland last week. They're nervous to drink the water in the building because last year testing found Legionella bacteria in some FDA buildings that causes Legionnaire's disease. Now, the agency notified employees coming back that it is safe to drink the water, but some say because they haven't made new testing results available, they just don't want to risk it. The FDA told me it's keeping employees up to date on their working conditions.
Can you give us a sense of how many people were teleworking or working remotely at least part of the time until now?
Well, about 10% of federal employees were fully remote, according to a federal government report last year. That's around 288,000 people, and many more had the ability to work from home sometimes. And of course, Michelle, teleworking increased a lot during the pandemic, but actually many federal agencies had been encouraging telework going back decades as a way of saving on costs around, like, you know, real estate, utilities, office space. The Office of Personnel Management found telework saved taxpayers more than $230 million in 2023, and the government was encouraging telework during the first Trump administration as well. You know, many of the employees that I spoke with said this is not about they don't want to go back into the office, that it's inconvenient, or that they're being lazy. They say that for them, remote work has enabled them to be more efficient, to be more productive, and that getting rid of it feels like an indirect way of pressuring them to quit. And they say it just doesn't make a lot of sense bringing people back into offices that can't accommodate them. It's actually going to cost the government money.
Seems like some of these goals are at cross purposes. So that is NPR Shannon Bond. Shannon, thank you.
Thanks so much.
This is NPR News.
Musical group Mariachi Mestizo has a new album which celebrates 25 years of teaching Mexican-American students to play and perform. That's next time, here and now.
The latest in national politics, inspiring podcasts, and a report from your local school board meeting last week. You can hear it all in one place with the NPR app. Download it today.
Good morning, I'm Michelle Martin. There's a wave of contraband arriving at the border. It's eggs, both the kind you scramble and the kind you raise. U.S. Customs and Border Protection says seizures of raw eggs at the Mexican and Canadian borders are up almost 50% over last year's numbers. Eggs in Canada can be half as expensive as in the U.S. And in Kentucky, Customs has seen a spike in seizures of so-called hatching eggs. Customs says this is not allowed because they can carry disease. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Bank of America. From local shops to global enterprises, Bank of America is committed to helping businesses of all sizes make every move matter. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. It took only a few seconds. USC star basketball player Juju Watkins sustained a season-ending injury during the women's NCAA tournament. Here's how that frightening moment played out on ESPN.
Great defense from the Trojans, and Watkins goes down hard, and she's grabbing her right knee, quickly grimacing in pain.
Watkins had to be carried off the court. USC confirmed she's injured her ACL and will be out for the rest of the season. As anybody who's ever had one knows, ACL injuries are painful, they can require months of rehab, and they are far more common in women athletes than in men. Here to talk about why is Dr. Christina Allen. She is the chief of Yale Sports Medicine and an ACL surgery specialist. She's also a former college athlete herself and has been a team physician for U.S. men and women's soccer. Good morning, Dr. Allen. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So two questions to start. How much more likely are ACL injuries in women than in men? And of course, I want to know, why are they so much more common in women?
Well, ACL injuries in women definitely are more prevalent. There's lots of studies out in the literature about the higher incidence in women going across lots of different sports that are comparable, like basketball, soccer. Of course, women don't usually play football, but that's an increasing sport. But it's definitely a higher injury rate. And a lot of that can be attributed to differences in anatomy and also just differences in training as women grow up. Anatomical differences include different quad hamstring ratio. Women tend to be more quad dominant. Alignment differences versus men. Also foot pronation. But there's also other issues just in terms of how, as women grow up, there's not as much emphasis on core strengthening and proprioceptive and agility work. That's improving over time. And as women now get into high school and college, there are strength and conditioning coaches, and that's helping to decrease the risk of injury.
So what does recovery look like for an ACL injury like the one we saw Watkins experience, which is obviously painful?
Yes, it's a longer recovery. It was refreshing to hear Rebecca Lobo say that it was going to be a year for her to get back on the court, because a lot of times in the past we've thought, oh, it's an ACL injury, they'll be back in 6 months, because everybody thinks about Adrian Peterson and his amazing recovery years ago when he tore his ACL when he was playing football. But now there's a huge emphasis on meeting milestones for recovery, including mental and physical milestones, getting strength back, making sure strength is 80% and before we even start running, then going through a running and agility type of cadence and making sure the athlete meets these milestones before a slow return to play. So that can take up to a year.
So before we let you go, you know, we've started talking much more openly about preventing injuries to begin with, you know, concussions, different equipment, things of that sort. Is there something that could be done to help prevent injuries like this from happening in the first place?
Absolutely. There's several programs out there. One of the most notable, since I was a soccer player, is the FIFA 11 Plus program that emphasizes running, strength, plyometrics, and balance programs, and also stretching to help reduce the risk of injury. But there's also the importance of adequate rest. I think a lot of these injuries happen late in the season, which increases the risk of injury.
That is Dr. Christina Allen. She's the chief of Yale Sports Medicine and an ACL surgery specialist. Dr. Allen, thanks so much for talking to us.
You're welcome.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Fadel.
1999 runs into 2025 in the form of Napster.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Progressive Insurance with Snapshot. Learn more about Snapshot at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Snapshot not available in California or from all agents.
I'm David Brancaccio in Los Angeles. Napster seemed like a great idea at the time with 80 million users until it became clear that the free downloaded songs were illegal. The company was sued out of existence, then resurrected. Now a virtual reality startup wants to turn Napster into an immersive metaverse for music. Here's Marketplace's Nova Safo.
Napster took off in 1999 when Ricky Martin was living La Vida Loca. And by the time it was resurrected as a legit music streaming service in 2011, Adele was singing about her broken heart. But Napster, bought by Rhapsody, never really took off as a streaming service. For example, it claims to have paid out only $1 billion in artist royalties so far. By contrast, Spotify says it's paid out nearly $60 billion. Now, Infinite Reality, a startup, has bought Napster for a bargain, a mere $200 million. The virtual reality company has been on an acquisition binge and also recently bought something apparently popular with the Gen Z crowd called Drone Racing League. The company says it wants to lean into its sports virtual reality know-how to create immersive music experiences, the types of things it says are very popular with 13 to 28-year-olds. I'm Nova Safo for Marketplace.
It makes sense, but we now have a number. Job applications are up 50% from current and former federal employees. This from the job search site called Indeed. Here's Marketplace's Samantha Fields.
Federal jobs used to be considered stable. Julia Pollack, chief economist at ZipRecruiter, says it's common for civil servants to stick around for a long time.
If you go to any government agency and you talk to the career staff there, many will say that they've been working in the agency for 40 years, 20 years, 30 years. Turnover is very low in the federal government.
And it's unusual to see lots of federal employees applying for new jobs outside the government. But that's what's happening now. Pollack says ZipRecruiter data backs up what Indeed found.
Federal workers are looking for new jobs. And this is not just the workers who have been cut. It is a much wider group than that. Many other workers in the federal government are worried that they could be on the chopping block next.
And many are trying to get out before they're forced out. But Andrew Stettner at the Century Foundation says it's a tough time to be looking for a new job.
Hiring has really slowed down. We're seeing college graduates have a more difficult time finding work. We're seeing the time on unemployment starting to grow. So people are going into that job market,
which may have trouble absorbing them, especially in parts of the country that lose a lot of federal jobs all at once, like D.C.
And also in other parts of the country where there's large concentrations of government workers like Colorado, Hawaii, Alaska. And we've seen the economists in those areas say, we do not have enough open jobs that match the skills and talent of people that are being laid off.
At least if they want to stay in the community. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
The Dow is up 189 points, 0.5%, but the S&P is down 0.4%. The NASDAQ down sharply, 1.1%. The Congressional Budget Office just said the federal government will exhaust its resources this August or September if Congress has not raised or suspended the federal debt limit by then. The nonpartisan CBO says that without congressional action, the U.S. could, after that moment, start defaulting on America's $36 trillion national debt.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Schwab. Schwab offers investors choices like full-service wealth management, self-directed investing options, and trading on thinkorswim. More at schwab.com.
It was a year ago this morning when Baltimore's Francis Scott Key Bridge collapsed after it was hit by a container ship. Six construction workers died, a crucial highway link destroyed, and the shipping channel to the Port of Baltimore blocked for 10 weeks. The three-century-old port handles a lot of cars, coal, plus construction and farming equipment. Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes looks at how businesses are doing 1 year later.
As he drives around the Port of Baltimore, Mark Schmidt points out giant cranes used to unload cargo from ships.
The cranes are like the coolest part.
Schmidt's president of Ports America Chesapeake, which runs Baltimore's container ship terminal. He actually started his career at the port over 30 years ago, repairing container ship cranes. And he still enjoys the challenge of moving cargo around.
It's a puzzle, and it's sophisticated and very high speed and techy.
But after the bridge fell, those cranes saw a lot less action. Schmidt says the company moved 35% fewer containers in 2024 compared to the year before. He says this affected revenue significantly. However, it could have been a lot worse. Early estimates of how long it would take to clear the shipping channel ranged from 6 months to a year. Instead, it took 74 days.
It could have been two or three times as bad as what we encountered. Really, really came back quickly, and really happy about that.
Ship traffic at the Port of Baltimore is back to about 90% of where it was prior to the bridge collapse. At Transamerican's warehouse near the port,
go and pull it.
Workers, including Greg Evans, are lashing a giant wooden box of cargo to a flat metal rack.
To make sure while it's on the ship, nothing tips over or floats no other way.
Last spring, they were doing a lot less of this work, says warehouse supervisor Timothy Summers.
We barely had any trucks coming in, barely had any containers.
And that worried him.
But with business slowing down, they might start laying people off, but good thing they didn't.
One of Transamerican's owners, Craig McGraw, says things are pretty much back to normal, though he did worry about losing customers long term.
The concern with us was that they were going to leave, go to another port, and then not come back. But once they realized that it wasn't going to be the 6 months, it was going to be shorter, you know, Baltimore's a great port, so they decided to stay with it from the looks of it.
Baltimore is known for its expertise in handling cars and other big rolling machinery. It's also the farthest inland port on the East Coast, which means items shipped here have less distance to cover on land. King Long Dai, who studies operations management at Johns Hopkins, says there's another factor that helped in the recovery. Some companies likely moved up shipments in anticipation of a longshoreman strike and tariffs.
There was a lot of rush, a lot of activity.
Overall, the port handled about 46 million tons of cargo last year, its second best year on record. Dai says whether that pace continues will depend a lot on economic factors outside of the port's control, like tariffs and how much consumers still want to buy all the things shipped in those containers. In Baltimore, I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
And in Los Angeles, I'm David Brancaccio. It's the Marketplace Morning Report from APM, American Public Media.
That lingering